Welcome to Avery Adventures Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Avery.
And I'm Tanya Avery.
And as always, we're brought to you by Mountain Ops. You can get 20% off using the code FATKID at mountainops.com. Today on the show, we have Calvin Holiday. Calvin is a young, I would say, entrepreneur. He owns Sheep Mountain Outfitters, and he works for Bob Beck at MOA Rifles. You say you're the sales manager there, Cal?
Yeah, I do pretty much all consumer sales.
All consumer sales. So you have to talk to customers every day.
I do. Yep. Every day. I work from my phone a lot.
I want to jump into that in a little bit, but I want to get into, you said you're 27 years old.
Yep.
27. How does a 27 year old guy get in front of so many big animals?
I think I would honestly say it's aligning yourself with the right people early on is pretty much how I'd sum it up. It's not because I was God's gift to hunting by any means or anything like that, and still aren't. Definitely wouldn't be arrogant enough to say that, but early on, I was able to set myself and co-align myself with people that were much better hunters than myself, and were either guides or outfitters themselves. So that is what really projected me quicker, I guess, at a younger age is what I'd say.
What do you mean you aligned yourself with them? Did you go work for them? Did you just, you know, like follow them around, do some sort of internship? Like, how did you align yourself with them?
Yeah, ask us that. Yeah. So I did absolutely everything, and I never said no. Was the biggest thing, and it was whether we were going shed hunting or we were going scouting or we were actually going hunting. I went with everybody that was better than myself every single opportunity I had, and I never said no to anybody. And eventually that turned into working for other outfitters, guiding for other outfitters, assisting in any way I could. I wanted to learn all the best country around, and I knew who the top dogs were and who those top guys were, and that's who I wanted to align myself with. So we became friends, and I think what you do as a hunter, guide, or an outfitter, or whatever, what have you, is you take a little bit from every single person that you learn from every time, and then those little bits kind of build you into who you are. So it's kind of funny. I've been on, you know, quite a few of these different podcasts now, and I'll have some of my mentors listen, and they'll be like, "Man, you said that saying that I say all the time," or whatever. And it's just like, yeah, I pick little things up from everybody all the time, and then it's kind of made me into who I am today. And I'm 27, I guess, so am pretty damn young in this game, but I plan on staying in it for a long time. So,
yeah, every time I turn around on Instagram, I see Sheep Mountain Outfitters, and you're not sitting down behind little tiny guys.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing about Sheep Mountain Outfitters is there's four of us. They're all partners in the business. So that's kind of it's a little different than a lot of guide outfitter businesses, is specifically in the state of Oregon, which I guess we should touch on, because Oregon, so Oregon is not really a state that's managed for giant trophy potential, or non-resident potential So, so we were kind of in an untapped market, if you would.
Yeah. You know, the thing that surprised me is we kind of split that Hell's Canyon between Idaho, our state, and Oregon, your state. So I know there was some big sheep and, you know, running around down in there, but where you guys are finding these big mule deer out of the state of Oregon is kind of shocked me.
Yeah, that's a big one. So two of my partners, Todd and Scott, are absolute mule deer fanatics. And I kind of came into it like into the sheep and goats and big elk. And they've since like totally indoctrinated me into this mule deer world, and I'm just completely addicted to it now. They're super fun. But Oregon is extremely difficult. Like hardly any of our animals or units are managed for trophy animals. So growing a mule deer old enough to be that size, it takes either straight luck, or it takes enough private ground that's put together that it can be managed as if it's its own game management unit. And that's kind of what we've all done.
So do you guys have to almost, I don't know how outfitting works. I mean, hell, I don't know how outfitting works in any state, but you guys do the whole state, or can you do the whole state, or they have specific areas, or how does that work?
Yeah, so that's really state dependent, and it's very tricky as well. So you have to have different permits for BLM land, Forest Service land versus wilderness land. It's a ginormous permit process. So if you're guiding on private lands, you have no permits required to do that whatsoever. Heck, you don't even have to be a licensed guide or an outfitter to do it. So some of our guided outfitting, yeah, some of it we do on private land. Some of it that we do on the public land, we have to hold those permits in order to be, you know, without in violation of any of the code in the state.
You know, that the outfitting thing, it's, and I'm sure you've heard the good and the bad and the ugly. People always, the DIY hunters always knock the outfitters always knock the DIY hunters. But as I've grown in this industry and learned more, man, I have to give it to the outfitters because they got to put up with a lot of shit from the public. B, they got to put up a lot of shit from the government. And they're usually, you know, good, honest guys just trying to make a living.
Yeah. And it's not a get rich business. I don't care who you're talking to. You can make good money at it. Sure. If you're putting down world-class animals on a consistent basis, you know, you can charge more for your hunts and make more money. Sure. That's great. But as I said before, there's four of us here that are involved, which shows you that there isn't one guy getting rich at all. You know, we are doing it out of the passion that we have for those big trophy animals. And that's what we're real interested in. You know, we don't run 40 elk hunters a year and kill 40 raghorn bulls or whatever. You know, we're just not into things like that. We'd rather kill a select few deer and have those select few deer be giant big deer or bighorn sheep or mountain goats or what have you. That's what we're all into. And we're just real passionate about big animals in general.
How did you get in, or I should say, does Sheep Mountain Outfitters do the whole gamut, every species that Oregon offers, or no?
We pretty much do everything except antelope. We really should. We our state grows some fantastic antelope. You know, the species I think that are not spoken about that Oregon grows real big is antelope and mountain goats. But it's not terribly popular. And again, neither of us have the expertise for those antelope. So, you know, I have antelope hunters come to me all the time and I just give them to other buddies and outfitters that I know are into it because they're the experts at it. And I don't want to fake the funk and act like I don't know. I've never had my hands on an antelope in my life, you know, so I don't know anything.
You guys all have like your own specialties. You said two of your partners were like mule deer guys. So is that how you guys figure out, you know, who does which hunts?
Yeah, we have, it's quite an orchestra getting that calendar all aligned, because we pretty much start with our auction bighorn sheep hunter on August 1st, and then we're about to finish up with our late season cow elk hunters in December. So we run nonstop from there to there. Dan and I were kind of like bighorn sheep guys. We're really into the bighorn sheep and mountain goats, like the mountain species. And Todd and Scott were originally kind of did a lot of the deer and elk hunting. So that's how it started. But now we've kind of all combined and we do everything together. So we're together on any of the mountain goats, bighorn sheep, deer, elk. We kind of all operate as one unit. And, you know, if a big deer surfaces in the state and we have a hunter that wants to hunt that deer, the nice part is there's four of us. So we can all jump together on a conference call and we can get over and get eyes on this deer and look at what this deer is and kind of work like that. So that's the beauty of having four people.
Yeah, that's nice. So you guys can, you know, split up your workload. If you've got stuff going on with your family or they've got stuff going on, it's not just all on your shoulders or on
other persons. We're all married, kids, you know, we're all regular guys. We have regular jobs. We just play a lot more than most people.
Yeah. Well, that's a choice. You guys, you know, set yourselves up that way. That's what a lot of people, you know, don't want to believe is that you've worked towards that goal. So you made it happen for yourself. It just didn't fall into your lap. You're not just lucky.
Totally. I that pisses me off when I hear that all the time. Like, oh, you're so lucky that you get to do that. You're so, and it's like, hey man, all of us at Sheep Mountain Outfitters and most of the guys I respect in the industry at some point made the decision that I'm going to take my passion and turn that into something that I can make money at and, or, you know, support myself and my family. Right. And yeah. I tell people all the time, like, you could do it too, man. If I could do it, I'm not a genius.
Yeah,
you can do it.
They just don't want to go through the years of blood, sweat, and tears and eating ramen to get there. They want it the easy way.
That, I think that's the biggest problem in our industry, and I hate that word. I get fucking lucky.
Yeah.
The thing is they only see the end product. They only see the grip and grin or packing out an animal or, you know, they don't see
the Instagram highlight reel.
Yeah, they don't see the, like on my, the Rockside side, they don't see me working two jobs and working 90 hours a week to make it work. They don't, yeah, they don't see Calvin Holiday hiking in there at 1 a.m. to get eyes on whatever animal. They don't see that end goal, and then they make it think like it's just easy and we're lucky, and I just despise that
word. Yeah, people say that all the time. Oh, you're so lucky. And it's like, it's there's no, I mean, there's maybe 1% luck, you know? I mean, yeah, the animal has to ultimately go where we can find it.
That yeah.
Pisses us off so bad.
From my side of things, I get so fired up about it just because I know the blood, sweat, tears, money, and divide it created between my wife and I. Early on, before I started guiding professionally or anything like that, I knew I had to get a lot of big animals under my belt to hit the scene, you know, in a slingshot, so to speak. Yeah. So I would go from hunt to, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I drove home to my house at midnight. My wife would wash my clothes and pack my stuff for me as I was packed, cleaning my gear and getting it ready. And I'd take off again to go to some other bighorn sheep hunt that I wasn't making any money on whatsoever. Heck, I was buying my own gas to get there. But I knew that who would book me and pay me for a once in a lifetime bighorn sheep hunt if I don't have anything under my belt and I haven't accomplished anything this point.
Right. And that's so another thing. If you're seriously into this game, and I've talked to thousands of people, you're going to have a little tension. Unless your wife is just different than any other woman I've ever met, you're going to have tension there.
Oh, totally. It's hard to justify to her. You know, you're going to be gone again and you're not making money at this. And you have to get them to see, you know, I guess in the military you use the saying, you know, you got to see the 300 meter target and not the 50 right in front of you. Right. And you have to say like, hey, my plan down the road when I start this is, you know, I'm a young guy. No guy's going to look at me and be like, yeah, that's the guy I want to take on my bighorn sheep hunt once right. in a while. Or some tag I spent $200,000 on. That's the kid I want to have take me, right? If that kid hasn't actually accomplished anything himself in the guiding industry. So yeah. You have to make a name for yourself. You have to do it. And I see a lot of other guys and outfitters say the same thing. Like, you know, well, gosh, we just struggle for hunters and you struggle for hunters. And I'm like, man. Just got to get them knocked down, and you got to make a name for yourself and a reputation, I guess.
Yep, that's what Gary Vee says. We listen to all the time, Gary Vaynerchuk, and he's like, you have to work for free. You have to be willing to do it for like 2 years, and then you know after that it'll come to you. And it's probably the best piece of advice that we've ever heard because it makes so much sense.
I love Gary Vee, by the way. That guy's awesome.
Oh my gosh, I worship him.
Well, but it's so true. It's so true. And, you know, you sacrifice your own hunts or your own time or your own money or your own wear and tear on your pickup because you realize how important that was. You learned about the country. You learned about the animal. You got another animal under your belt. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And eventually you can project yourself in the position we're talking about now at being a very young age, or you're aligned with, you know, my partners in the outfitting business who are older and more experienced than I was. You know, so they kind of
see baby face Cal or this grizzled vet and you're dropping down $100,000 or whatever. It's like, you know, human nature is who do you decide?
It's a total, you know, if we use some of these, look at, you know, Adam Bronson, Randy Johnson, some of these guys that are some of the top sheep guides in the industry out there. They've been playing this game a long, long time. They've earned the respect. They've earned where they're at and they've earned it through experience. So you've got to get yourself there some way. And the only way to get there is work hard.
That's the key. It ain't luck. It's hard fucking work.
Yeah.
And just, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned about your wife because it is a work family balance and you know, you have to figure that out and every situation is going to be different for every person too. I mean, you can't just blanket give advice like, oh, well, this is what you need to say and this is what you need to do. And this is what, because that's not going to work for everybody. Everybody's personalities are different. Their situations are different. So
100%, Tanya. And I can't even emphasize that enough because much like Ryan, I started young and in the military. So my wife, when she first met me, was used to me being gone for long, long periods at a time. And that was fine. But then I'd come home and I'd go hunt, you know, and do these things. So it's super, super hard for her to see that long goal down the line. And now we have, you know, a 2-year-old and another baby on the way any day now. You know, so
right. No, it's probably, and it was hard for me to realize that or believe the work versus play aspect of hunting.
Yes,
because that was a bigger fight than most fights that we ever have. Is
right.
no, I have to do this for my work. And I'm like, no, bitch, you're not doing it for your work. You're not even close doing it for your work.
You're going to hang out with him, or you're going to hunt with him.
Exactly. Because his moose hunt, that was an epic disaster. I mean, people were flying in. Our friends were flying in from Alaska to go hang out. I mean, there was like 12 people at moose camp, and he's trying to convince me how he's doing this for work. And I about cut his throat. I'm like, are you serious right now? Are you really thinking I'm that stupid?
It was awesome.
So, yeah. And I definitely don't have it figured out. I'm, you know, like we said, I'm 27. I've been married, going on 4 years now. I've been with my wife for 8, and I have, like, I've learned some things along the line. I've taken bits and pieces from everybody. So now my best advice I can give people is I have like a giant calendar in the house, and as early on as I can, we start writing on that calendar, her and I, you know, and then she'll highlight stuff that I can't miss, whether it be a baby appointment or, you know, something like that, that I've got to be there for. And I respect that just as much as she respects my most important hunt of the year, you know. And that way I can always say, refer, hey, it's been on the calendar, you know, like you knew this was coming. And I think she compartmentalizes it better, being able to see it visually and right there. And it's not like I'm springing something on her. So that's helped. And the other biggest one, and I got to give it to Bob Beck here, actually, I learned this from him, is when family time is happening, that's family time 150%. Like I was, and I still struggle with this. I'm on my phone all the time, or somebody's calling me or texting me, or I'm answering an email, or I mean, I bet you're the same way, Ryan. When you're enveloped in this industry, that's just how it is. Cause there's great people and hunting partners. You want to keep up on what everybody's doing too. But I have to like value family time to the nth degree and just put the phone down and just know that these days are rare for me, and that's what I have to do. So that's helped me immensely. And I'm glad I learned that early on, or I'd probably be divorced already.
That's actually a really great piece of advice. I think a lot of people think if they're present, then they're there, but they're really not, because they're staring at their phones. Or
you're literally saying exactly what she told me. She's like, it's here. It's like you're here, but you're not here. Right. And then I'm like, yeah, you're right. I'm bad about that.
That's
she
my
kicks me out sometimes about that.
Yeah, stopping work it's like a gray area. It's like you never really stop, but you have to.
Yeah.
To disconnect.
Yeah, and working for MOA Rifles, Extreme Outer Limits, it's like I make my living selling from my phone all the time, and it's always answering an email or, you know, but I'll get up before the family gets up and get my work done, and then I know that's family time, or I'll work later when they go to bed or whatever. But Bob's been a pretty big mentor as far as helping me out with that, because he's lived that life for a long time as well. And, you know, you got to be selling all the time, and you know, our customers spend really good money buying really high-end rifles. And I can't tell you, Ryan probably gets these too. I'll get a phone call that's like, hey, man, I'm 655 yards. The wind's blowing 10 miles an hour left to right. What's my wind call? Or, you know, I'm like, oh, my gosh, hang the phone up and shoot it. You know, but that happened. And you got to, like, people expect that level of, like, customer service if they're buying a product like that. So that's where we live in. So,
although, you know, that's great that you say, like, to me and Shelby, I don't know if she is going to be the same way or think the same way, but even if he said, okay, I'm going to power my phone down for 2 hours, and then in that time, you know, I'm just going to be present. It's like just even little chunks of time, if you can commit that and commit it 100%, that would make a huge difference.
100%. It's made leaps and bounds for us. And it's with Shelby and my 2-year-old daughter as well. You know, she needs her time. She needs her time. And I don't even know what hurricane I'm about to step into when this gets through. But if it's anything like I'm predicting, it's going to require even more time. So just got to be prepared to do that.
It's going to require more time, brother.
And it just gets worse.
Because ours are 17 and 15. So they're going to be about the same distance apart as yours.
Yep.
And it's like double the trouble. It is. It's just no way around it.
Yeah. As they get older, they just require, you think they're going to be less, but they're more.
So I'm excited for it, but it'll be challenging, I'm sure. And I'll mess up and I'll probably fall down 5 times, but I'll get up every time and keep working at it. And hopefully she sticks with me, I guess. So
Yeah. You know, I'm a firm believer. You can't do this, but you have to have a good spouse to do this kind of work.
And I'm super, super blessed. She is way too patient and way too good looking for me. So I'll just count my blessings as it is.
Well, before I jump into the MOA rifles part, you've been around the block now on these animals. What would you say is the hardest trophy animal to kill?
Oh boy. So I would say if I was just talking about the state of Oregon, to kill a true trophy quality bull elk is probably the hardest trophy to kill.
You would know, brother. You guys yes. put some time in.
And that's just the state specifically. But I will say that is a general whole about species. I think a big mature mule deer is pretty unmatched. Trying to kill a big mature mule deer, a 200 inch plus kind of deer, is about as difficult as it gets.
I would argue that it sounds like a 400 inch bull is hard to
yeah, yeah. Extremely difficult. You know, and I've been fortunate enough to hunt with Bob around the country, and we've kind of had what we deem the elk year this year, and Bob had four pretty premium elk tags. And I got to go hunt elk in a lot in different areas of the country that they're managed in total different ways. And I still think killing a 200 plus inch mule deer is more difficult.
That's interesting you say that, because yeah. a few other people that I know that hunt both and in the know, they say the same thing. 200 inch mule deer are just yeah. hard to find.
It's absolutely so tough. If the area has elk, you know, the trophy quality elk, let's say 370 plus bulls, we can kill them. They just have to live there. If they don't live there, can't kill them if they don't live there. So I love bighorn sheep too. The hardest thing about killing bighorn sheep is finding him. Once you find him,
the tag is harder.
Yeah, that's the most difficult thing. Yeah, you're telling me. I just keep flying. Yeah, but once you find a bighorn ram and it's a ram you're after, you know, sometimes what different rams are harder than others and they move more. But usually when it comes to getting them killed, it's not nearly as difficult as some of the other species. And then like mountain goats are my other passion, and mountain goats are the hardest animal to guide a client on if they're number concerned, as far as in reference to what that animal scores, because he could be 48, he could be 52, and I don't care how good you are, that's pretty damn tough to look a guy in the eye and tell him, oh, he's 50 for sure, you know.
I never hunted them, only looked at them yeah. through the spotter. I can only imagine, because all white with a little black off the top of his head, it has to stand just perfect.
Very, very difficult, you know. I try and get most guys to be into the fact that it's a big mature billy, and that's what they're looking for. And nobody ever looking at a mountain goat on your wall is going to go, oh, well, that's a 47-inch mountain goat or a 51, or, you know. But some guys are concerned about the numbers. Some are not. They're just into it for the hunt, and I think they're a really cool species to hunt. But, heck, if you're off an eighth of an inch on their base, I mean, you're off 4 inches on that animal by the time you get all the way up to the horn. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah, see, I weigh – sheep has never, you know, tripped my trigger. A goat – just the way they are, how tough they are.
Oh.
You know, they just, I want to kill one in my life. I don't care if I ever kill a sheep. I don't. But a goat.
I've never personally seen an animal eat bullets as well as Rocky Mountain goat will. It's pretty impressive what they'll do.
The only guy I know that hunts sheep or goats every year is Luke Moffitt, and he concurs. He's like, you can just hit them and hit them and hit them, and they won't fall down.
And they just soak them up. And I've had guys put arrows right through them, right in the lungs, and then live for hours. I just like, how does that happen? It's incredible. And the bad part is when they get wounded, they generally, their defense mechanism is to go crawl up into some nasty crevice that they basically got to back into. And I don't care who you are, mountain goats can sometimes go places that humans just can't go. So got to be aware of that.
On the big Bobby Beck side, how did this all transpire? I knew you were a bow hunter when I first started
yep.
figuring out who Cal Holliday was. And then you kind of transferred over into the longer range stuff. I know you guys still bow hunt, but how did the whole MOA Extreme Outer Limits deal go down?
Yeah, I definitely started out as bow hunter. I rifle hunted sometimes, but just kind of like most average rifle hunting guys, you know, I'd say. And Bob bought an Oregon auction tag. And he called me one day out of the blue, and I knew he had had a tag, right. But he called me, and he was talking about his hunt, and he was asking a lot of questions about his hunt, and I wasn't interested in guiding him whatsoever because those hunts are very long, and I didn't have the time to do it and wasn't prepared to do it. And he goes, man, everybody I talk to says you're the guy to call about this hunt, and why is everybody telling me to call this punk-ass 25-year-old kid? And he, like...
On a side note, if you haven't ever talked to Bob, you know exactly what Bob thinks. And the word no is not really a word Bob likes to hear.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This story is going to be a perfect example of that. So we talk, and I like Bob because I like guys that are kind of bottom line up front kind of people. I respect that about them, and that's how Bob is. And he said, well, I want to come talk to you about it. And Bob lives in Newburgh, Oregon. I live in La Grande, Oregon. We're 5.5 hours apart. And I said, oh, you don't need to do that. He's like, no, I'm coming. I'm driving over there.
It don't matter what you say. I'm coming.
Yeah, I'm literally, get ready for me. I'm going to be there. We're going to go to dinner, you know. So he comes, and it was like all I can compare it to is like a enlisted army, like a promotion board. Like, you're just sitting there and just getting absolutely grilled by this guy. And he wants to know, you know, I was sharing with him my experiences. We're going over maps and this and that. And then it was like, I want you to work for me. And I'm like, I had a job that I was doing. I was perfectly happy. And I said, I don't need a job, Bob. He's like, I didn't ask you if you needed a job. I want you to work for me.
That escalated quickly.
Yeah. And that was just, he's like, I finally feel like I'm talking to somebody who's very similar to myself. And I'm looking for somebody that's just like myself to work for. And so I told him no. I mean, right off the beginning, you know, I was not even prepared for that. And we started hunting together. He actually came on one of my spring bear hunts, and we filmed one of my spring bear hunts. And that's when he started teaching me about the long range game. And I'd learned, you know, Ryan, kind of probably like you in the military and using mils and mil rads and everything like that. But switching over to the MOA side of things and learning about how to do it effectively hunting big game was a totally new world to me. And Bob made me go to his shooting school just like a basic student did. And for the first year, my first MOA rifle that I shot was just and I'm really glad he did this, a 7mm REM mag shooting 168 VLDs. And I killed everything on planet Earth with that gun.
Seven mag is a good little rifle.
That gun killed half a dozen bighorn sheep, mountain goats, deer, elk, all over the sun. And so I learned what you know, in the long range game, what's probably considered a very basic caliber choice as far as and bullet choice. I learned what that was capable of. So then I learned really how we're splitting hairs when we're talking about these Ferrari cartridges and bullet choice. Down the road. So I learned a valuable lesson from that. And one thing led to another. And now I work for Bob, and I do consumer sales mostly, but I truly kind of do anything and everything Bob needs. He's got 5 different companies. So I kind of oversee anything that Bob can't handle himself if he's gone, and do everything like that, do all the trade shows, instructed a lot of the shooting schools. I go hunt with Bob all over the place, and then the camera crew comes and hunts with me as well to make different episodes for the TV show. And all in there, I'm still in the National Guard, and I do the outfitting gig too. So,
wow.
Whoa. Do you do anything with like the star outfitting part of Bob's business?
Yes, I do. I do a lot. I help with some of the booking. I talk with a lot of the clientele. We're looking at doing some long range schools down there in Wyoming. So I make proposals for the Forest Service in regards to that. But Bob has a commercial sales guy, Robbie, who actually does a lot of the, he goes to Star Valley himself. I just simply can't, because when Bob's there, I've got to kind of hold the ship down as far as sales for the company while he's hunting there. Because he's there for a month usually. So
that gets back to the, you don't take the word no very easy.
No. I mean, he's a smart guy. He's a smart guy. He's a hard charger, and he's good. His business mind is pretty impressive, how he can put people in the right places, and they'll succeed when he puts them in there. So,
oh, there's no question from what he's done in the hunting industry that he has an eye on what he's doing.
Oh, for sure. He's a self-made guy. Very, very intelligent. He's rough around the edges, and he'll tell you exactly what he feels. There'll never be a question about what he's thinking. But I've learned a lot from him. Yeah, great guy, hard worker.
He is a hard, he can tell, and I appreciate those kind of guys. And I've been around a lot of those type of guys, so I love to give Bob shit when I talk to him. I just love
oh yeah, that. You can get him really fired up about it. He can't. Bob has a real issue turning it off. He just can't. And I'll be like, hey, let's stop talking about effing work for 2 minutes. And it's just, Bob is a goer all the time. And
well, you know, the real star of Extreme Outer Limits is Chris anyways.
Oh, yeah. That's what everybody at the trade shows tells us all the time. They come up and say, Chris, I know you shoot way better than he does.
Well, I'll never forget. And I give him shit every time I see him about, it was 3-4 years ago on a bull somewhere, I think in Colorado. And he literally knocked Chris out of the way to shoot at this bull.
And Chris is the other side of it. She does a lot of the managerial duties for all the 5 companies, and she does a ton of paperwork, and she does a ton of the behind the scenes stuff, and then jumps in front of the camera and films episodes, all while still being a mom and having kids. So it's a family run gig. It really is. So it's pretty cool.
As in most cases, a woman's a rock star, doesn't get any of the credit.
I was super excited to meet Chris when we where were we at, Reno? No.
That's when we met Cal, too, at the
expo. No, I remember, yeah. But I was like, oh, hey, Bob, yeah. Wait, where's Chris?
She seems to be more popular at the booth than either any of us.
Oh, yeah, I mean, hell, I don't know any too many women that have done what she's done, especially in the long range side.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's very, very few, if any, out there that are doing the long range stuff that Chris has done and put down the animals she's put down the last few years. So,
and be normal about it, not fake. So that's awesome.
That's, I think, something that's very attractive about Chris is she's not egotistical by any means.
No.
And she's very down to earth. She'll talk to anybody. And Bob said on our podcast, he said, you know, Chris, you're really the only girl in the long range game. And she goes, oh, I never really even thought about that. You know, and that just goes to show where her mind's at.
Genuine always comes through, especially in video.
Yeah.
You know, and you can tell she's very genuine. That's who she is.
Yeah. And there's no pulling punches. And any woman that can be married to Bob Beck deserves instant respect.
I concur with that 100%.
So she deals with Bob and she deals with me and all the other guys in our company. Yeah, Chris deals with everybody real well, so I can't say enough good things about her for sure.
Okay, on the MOA rifles, you've seen them all. What's your favorite caliber and what's your favorite model?
Oh boy, that's a pointed question.
They give you one gun tomorrow, Cal. You got to hunt with it the rest of your life.
Sure. So if I got one gun, it would probably be a Lapua. Is probably what I would do. Something big.
Just a standard Lapua, or improved? Yeah.
Improve for sure.
But giving him one gun.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. But that's just because what I've learned about shooting heavy bullets in real life hunting conditions is what I that's the biggest picture I wish people could get. You know, say what you will about Berger or Hornady or whatever. I don't care what bullet manufacturer you want to shoot. Ballistic coefficient is king in my opinion when you're actually in real true life hunting conditions. You know, I shoot as well as I shoot, and that gun is built to shoot as well as it shoots, and everything is there. But bottom line at the end of the day is we've got to shoot an animal at an extended range. I need the largest margin for error I can have to ethically kill the animal. And that's just the best way I can depict it to people. So why would you shoot a 300 Ultra Mag and shoot a 160 grain bullet when you could shoot a 245 grain bullet out of that same gun and your wind call is going to be 1/3 the wind call, right? That's just the way I see it. So, and I've learned that from Bob early on, and I've seen the results of it in the field, not just speaking about it on a podcast or writing on a blog or, you know, things like that. So
why does Bob keep going back to that damn 195?
He loves the 195 and he loves it for damn good reason. I mean, I have seen him do some crazy stuff with it. It's pretty impressive. Low recoil, obviously. The other year, Bob shot that 195 out of a standard rem mag in our Extreme Summit gun, our real lightweight rifle. Mm-hmm. And he killed everything from moose, black bear, elk. I mean, it was absolutely insane that he killed with that 7 rem mag going like 2,850 feet a second.
With a 195, he's shooting a 7 mag?
Yep, all the time. We do it all the time.
That's impressive.
And, just shoots amazing. 28 Nosler is much more popular. And then, you know, 7 Rum still has a little popularity as well. But
I'm under. I mean, I can only say it's only two elk.
Yep.
I'm very under impressed with the 195 out of 28 Nosler compared to a 30 Cal 230.
I've seen him do. I mean, we just killed him last week.
I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying from my what I've seen,
yeah,
they like to walk around.
Yeah, there's 30 cal guys and 7 mil guys and all under the sun. I'm a big fan of the 28 with the 195. I've seen it do some amazing things. This year I did shoot a 300 Ultra Mag, shooting the big burgers out of it and really, really enjoyed it. But bottom line is most people in most cases aren't going to shoot that rifle as well as they can something in smaller caliber. And it just is like a sliding scale. You know, we've seen the leg humpers for the 6.5 Creedmoor and all that stuff, you know, and it's pretty cool to lay behind a 6.5 Creedmoor, a 6.5 284 or whatever, and watch the bullet impact the target. And I think shooters can get away with a lot more shooting that rifle than they can say a 300 Ultramag shooting 230 burgers at it.
What can you talk about any of the EOL that's coming out, any EOL line of bullets or not?
Yeah. Extreme Outer Limits has a branded line of bullets with Berger coming out. And there's several bullets in this line. And they're game changers. Basically, they're heavy for caliber, and they're a hybrid jacketed and form bullet. And the real popular one is the 195. That kind of started the line. The next one we have coming out is a 155 grain bullet for the 6.5s. And it's awesome. It's great. I've been shooting out of a 6.5 284. It's been great. Fantastic.
What's the BC on the 155?
It is not finalized yet, but it's right around 675 G1, which is fantastic. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. It's great for 6.5 284, 26 Nosler. We've even been shooting it out of a Creedmoor a little bit. So I know Brozovich was just shooting it out of a Creedmoor and they killed an elk with it or something the other day.
No, Broz.
Yeah. So that's a cool one. We have a 30 cal bullet coming out. It's a 245. I know Ryan's just super excited about that one too.
That's going to be my bullet.
That's going to be fantastic. And a 330 grain bullet coming out for the 330.
Now you can tell me you don't have any idea, but have you shot a 330 yet?
Have not. No.
How do you think, you know, you built a 330 at Lapua Improved, you said.
That's what we're doing now. Yep.
Or you shot one. How was it, a sub 10 pound rifle?
No, right around 12 pound rifle.
Scoped?
Yes, scoped. Yep.
How was the recoil on that level?
I don't think it's bad at all, but I'm not a recoil shy person. So I'm kind of a bad guy to ask. I'm a guy that tells you, I think a 28 Nosler snaps you more than a 330 at Lapua when you shoot it. They have different tendencies in the way that they recoil. And generally, you know, a 6 pound gun that's 28 Nosler versus a 12 pound rifle that's a, you know, 330 at Lapua, I think that Lapua beats you up less all day long.
I shot a 9 pound scoped 330 at Lapua Improved.
The tough rifle to shoot. Yeah.
300 grain bullet. And I'll have to say I'm not recoil sensitive or insensitive. I mean, I notice it, but that was about all I could take.
So we do our Extreme Sporter rifle, which is like a 7 pound gun, ends up being right around 9 pounds scoped generally. And we do those in Lapuas for some guys. And they shoot them fine. You know, it's not as easy a rifle to shoot as a McMillan A35 and a Sendero weight barrel and things like that. But they shoot them pretty good. So I'm always impressed with that. But
heck yeah, me too.
I'm not a super, as much of a sheep hunter and mountain hunting guy I am, I'm not a super lightweight gun guy myself.
Hunting in Idaho, and how big was that 300 rum? Tell us about that shot on that deer.
Yeah, so I just, like I said, I don't claim to have been doing this long range thing for a long time, but I think I'm learning from one of the best teachers in the industry.
Absolutely.
And I took a deer with a 300 Ultramag at 1176 with that rifle. So 26 minutes elevation, or just over 26 minutes and 2 minutes of wind. And it was fantastic. I mean, really impressive. Perfect conditions. I had a perfect rest with our bipod and rear rest, and took the shot and stoned him dead. So it was a good gig. But
you said 1126 yards?
1176.
1176. I want to kind of highlight that a minute because people throw around long range a lot. And very few people that throw around that long range have actually shot that long range.
Yeah.
And once you, to me, once you hit that 800 yard mark, it's not automatic anymore. And I don't care what you're shooting. So 1176 yards in a place you've probably never been before.
Yep. Yep.
And so you don't know exactly always what the wind's doing. That's a hell of a shot.
Yeah, I haven't got to shoot there before. And it was a cross canyon shot. And, you know, I was using a G7 rangefinder, but I had a Kestrel with me as well. So I got to take a wind reading as well and kind of compare notes as far as what I thought. And I thought it was about a minute and a half wind call, and I gave it another half minute for spin drift, and it was on the money. So
yeah, that's a great shot because this is me talking. It's not Cal. That 1400 yards out of the box bullshit is bullshit.
Yeah. It's, you know, we do shooting schools, both kind of a beginning course and then an advanced course. And then we do some advanced courses followed by an actual physical hunt after then. And Bob has no problem making our shooters miss at school, which other schools in the industry are not necessarily about that. They want to shoot off a bench, controlled conditions, shoot on a range that is bermed on all sides. And that is not realistic to true hunting scenario. So we go out there and we're shooting in the sagebrush from the prone position off a bipod with a rear bag or our rear rest system, real life as it gets. And it just because it's windy that day doesn't mean we don't shoot, you know?
Exactly.
So we have some days that the wind lays down and our course goes from, our first target is 400 yards on the big course and it goes out to 2000 yards. And we'll have students on clear, no wind days, clear that course by 2 p.m. It's absolutely amazing and impact all the way to 2000. Wow. But on days that it's windy, you'll see they'll struggle because we don't let them jump a target until they get a confirmed hit on that, the previous target. Right. That's but awesome. I truly think that those students that hunt or that shoot on the windy days, they walk away with a lot more knowledge because they missed a lot more than the rest of the guys. And I don't like sending anybody away that shot at 1800 yards and they dialed their scope, you know, oh yeah, it's a you know, 32 minute shot, bam, hit it first shot. And they just think that they're going to walk out in the field and do that. Cause we just know that's a fallacy if we're being honest with ourselves.
No, I don't care who you are. I've shot with some of the greatest shooters and even 700-800 yard shots makes some people look stupid that are phenomenal, phenomenal wind call guys.
Totally agree. In our course, we really see, I mean, guys will just bang that target from 4 to 1,000 generally very consistently. And then it's this weird dynamic about jumping from the 1,000 to the 1,200. The whole game changes. And then 12 to 14 and 14 to 18, it's just amazing every single time. And we tell people it's a novelty, right? When you're shooting out that 1,800-yard stuff, and I mean, it's a novelty for most people in most setups. But when they clear that course to 2,000 and then they turn left and they shoot that 600-yard target, it's like child's play at that point for them. It's a totally different gig.
Yeah, that is one thing you noticed because I try to shoot. I'm lucky to live where I live. There's a lot of places to shoot out to 2 grand. When you take that 2 grand shot and those 1,400 and 1,600 and then you go down to 700, 800, you're like, huh, no big deal.
Yeah, I mean, he's dead if I want to pull the trigger right now kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's those guys that just go out and shoot 800 and 900 and they're playing in it no problem. And then they jump to an animal at 800 yards, but all of a sudden it's October and there's a 20 mile an hour crosswind that wasn't there in August or whenever they were shooting there. That's what.
Then we get a phone call, right? That's what generally
you get happens. Your phone call.
Yeah.
It always cracks me up. Guys say, oh, well, you know, you talk about going to the range. Oh, it's a terrible day for the range because it's raining and windy.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's perfect day for the range.
Yeah. And I shoot all year long. It's funny how dead it is from December to August. And then all of a sudden it's really active. And those are the guys that are out there shooting long range. You're like, oh, shit.
Yeah, they shoot like 3 times at the target and pack up and go home.
100%. And we really try and focus our students at like actually learning how it goes. We don't hold any secrets to them as far as how to truly trajectory validate your rifle and what that barrel is going to do between round 0 and 80 and how we clean our rifles and everything like that. Because we're truly trying to make these guys the best and most ethical long range shooters we can. Because we know that hunter is going to take that gun. He's going to go to XYZ's outfitter camp in Wyoming. And then he's going to tell everybody about his brand new MOA rifle. And he loves it in this. And we want that guy to be effective and lethal, not be a joke out there and just think he's going to dial a yardage turret and go kill something, right?
Yeah. I think if you can get guys to know when not to shoot, you've really won.
Oh, that's almost the most important thing you can teach.
I think the shooting schools, a lot of guys are prideful, and they think that if they attend one that they are admitting that they don't know things. And for a lot of guys, they don't want to do that. But I think everybody should go to one of those shooting schools. I mean, a good one like your guys's and Red Rock, because it teaches you so much and gives you so much confidence. If you're spending that much money and time on a hunt, why wouldn't you prepare yourself the best that you can beforehand? I don't ever understand why people don't think that way.
It's so true. And we tell people can come, you know, not every school's like this. We let guys bring their own rifles if they want. Whatever setup they want to bring. Oh, no problem. We don't care, because we know you're going to buy an MOA by the time you leave anyway. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, if you want to bring your Sendero and Leopold with a CDS turret on it, like, you're more than welcome to bring it. And then, you know, Bob and these guys will get in arguments sometimes. It's amazing how prideful some men can be about their shooting and say, well, hell, I've shot like this for this long. And Bob will look the guy straight in the face and say, hey, you're paying me to come to my school. You're going to do it the way we do it here. And I, just because I'm going to force you into uncomfortability, and then you're going to learn, and you're going to shake my hand at the end of school and say, okay, now I get it. That's why you do it like that. So
yeah, I'm not easily impressed. And some of Bob's shots on video, they're pretty impressive. It's hard to argue.
He shoots like a house of fire. It's pretty impressive all the time. And he doesn't get to shoot as much as he'd like anymore, but I'll be thinking I'm doing pretty good, and he'll come out and just show us up pretty quick. So.
How, out of all the rifles, what's the most popular caliber you guys sell?
Hands down this year, 28 Nosler has been the most popular. And then I'd say 300 Ultra Mag probably be second. 7 Rem Mag is still very popular for us. And then we do quite a few Lapuas. And this year, the 6.5 leg humping crowd has come on strong. So,
what caliber 6.5 or what cartridge?
Creedmoor has been insanely popular. I mean, no joke, Bob said, when it first came out, I said, we are not doing Creedmoors. We are not doing them. Absolutely not. Because, you know, it's a performance. We shoot the most performance-driven calibers that are out there, right? And there's so many better, higher-performing cartridges than a 6.5 Creedmoor out there. So Bob just saw it. No, you know. Then we built one, shot it, and when you shoot it on the range, you're like, okay, I get it. That's why these guys want to shoot it. And if it's a trainer gun or a guy's building it for a kid or whatever, then have at it. And I tell you what, we have sold a lot of 6.5 Creedmoors as well.
It's just nice and easy. Tanya shot a cat with one, and she's like, damn, I really like that gun.
Oh, it's just, they're super fun. Just like, you know, I had a 12-year-old bighorn sheep client this year, and then I hunted with Robert Hanneman's son, who was 12, on a mountain goat hunt in Washington. And Bob had us put together a 6.5 284. And I hadn't shot one of those for a long, long time. And I laid down behind that rifle and shot, you know, a sub-3-inch group at 600 yards, and I watched every bullet hit the target. And I just said, oh, my gosh, that was really – that's pretty fun. I need to think about something like this.
I can see why that. I think where they get mixed up is when they try to shoot, say, like elk at 700, 800. I think that's where they really start tripping over themselves.
Yeah, and that's something we really try and talk to the clients about as well. You know, Berger will generally tell you if you drop below 1,800 feet per second, you don't expect rapid and controlled expansion. And, I mean, if we're being transparent, have we gotten away with much slower velocities than that? For sure. Sure we have. But you really shouldn't push it below that threshold. And we teach people not to push it below that threshold. So then you look at some of these cartridges, the Creedmoor in specifically, and it's like, hey man, this is really your true ethical range that you should be shooting this rifle in. And you really shouldn't even consider shooting anything further. If you are going to consider to shoot something further, you need to be shooting a different caliber.
Yeah. And I think if you, on that 1800 feet per second deal, is if you're talking about 18 or let's say 1500 feet per second with a 230 versus a 140, there's a huge amount of difference.
Huge difference, right? But the one consistent thing in that 1800 feet per second is if we're looking, like, let's just compare VLD hunting bowls because we're talking about Berger. The jacket thickness is the same on that 230 as it was the 140, right? So the jacket still has to malform, but the malformation of the jacket caused by the lead core is a lot different in a 230 grain bullet than a 140 grain bullet. There's a lot more lead behind that bullet causing malformation of the jacket.
So I get this question a lot, and maybe you can explain it even easier. The target bullets, which I've actually killed way more animals with than the VLDs, Are sure. They're a little thicker at the front.
Is that 3/3000ths of an inch thicker jacket?
Do you guys hunt with the targets at all?
All the time.
Yeah, me too.
We kill stuff with the hybrid target all the time. I get that question really often, and I am at the utmost confidence, no matter what caliber, that the hybrid target is extremely efficient at killing animals. And Bob went over to New Zealand and killed, I'm not even going to tell you how many animals with them, doing actual bullet testing on live animals at extreme ranges. Uh-huh. And they'd go over to those animals and cut them open and actually see what the bullet performance was. And we were doing the same with that 155 this year, you know, because there was the first time that bullet had ever shot a live game animal. We need to see what the performance was doing before it's released to the consumer market.
How does that EOL line differ between the tactical or the target and the VLDs?
It's a standard hybrid jacket. So it falls between a VLD hunting and the OTM, which is the tactical bullet. And I don't recommend ever shooting an animal, obviously, with the OTM tactical bullets at all.
I've shot a lot with the 300s.
I've seen a lot of people do that too. So we recommend if a guy's going to wants to shoot the 300 for hunting, the Elite Hunter, which has a hybrid jacket, it'd be the bullet of choice.
So that's 3/1000ths less?
Correct. Yep. So it's from the VLD hunting, you jump up 3/1000ths to the hybrid target, and then you jump up 3/1000ths more to the OTM.
Is there any difference in the hollowness of the nose?
No, not that I've ever been told.
That's so good information.
The instruction to be the same, it's just a jacket thickness difference.
Yeah, I hear that all the time. And I did have an issue. I shot a cow or a bull elk spike. I think it was like 600 yards or maybe 700 yards. I shot it with a 230 OTM and just zinged right through.
Yep. And, you know, shooting live animals, angles, distances, penetration, where you hit it, there's all those different differences. But I'm super confident in the hybrid. No problem about it. The OTM target bullet was designed for a different purpose, and big game wasn't the purpose.
I'd like to ask you this question because you'll give me a different answer than most because you bow hunted and long range hunted.
Yep.
There's always an argument that long range hunting isn't hunting. What is Cal Holliday's definition of long range hunting as opposed to bow hunting?
Sure. It's a completely different type of hunting. But I will argue tooth and nail that it's hunting for damn sure. The methods in which I hunt are just completely different. If I have a rifle that I know, I mean, let's just use the old 1400 yard saying that we were laughing about yesterday. Say, I got this brand new gun out of a box and it's 1400 yards ready to go. Just dial the turret and shoot, right? Mm-hmm. Then the way I'm going to hunt a canyon is completely different than how I'd go hunt that canyon with either in a standard off-the-shelf production rifle or a bow or a stick bow for that matter, right? And I know that if I where I walk when I have a long-range capable rifle is different than where I'd walk if my gun's only capable of shooting 400 yards in that canyon. So case in point, Bob's bull that we just killed, Oregon auction tag bull, we killed it last week. The bull was in a canyon we had located. And if you were going to kill him with a standard production rifle, the only way to do it would have been to sneak in on that bull's same side of the canyon and actually come down on him and kill him, jump shoot him essentially at close range. Or in our case, we set up on an opposite hogback from him and waited for him to get up out of his bed and kill him at just over 500 yards. And that was a far more, I would say, far more percentage of getting that bull killed ethically and effectively than just jump shooting him out of his bed and getting him killed. Or if I was hunting him with a bow, what would I do? I'd wait till the wind was right, I'd come down on him, and I'd still hunt the bull. That's how I'd have to do it.
Right. I think that the problem with long-range hunting is it, when you do videos and it's portrayed online or anywhere it's in video form, is they don't know, A, how long you've been there, how many shots you didn't take, and the actual practice and performance it takes to actually make that shot.
The rounds on target all year, the trajectory validation consistently all the time, getting it absolutely dialed, and then getting in there, doping the elements and knowing what it's got to be. And you're right. I mean, you could start blazing away if you wanted to, but you just realize that it's just not an effective way to hunt. And I think, a lot of the time, some of the best long-range hunters, I think, in the industry are great bow hunters as well, or started out as great bow hunters. Bob was a huge bow hunter before he started. Yourself, John Pinch comes to mind. guys, I don't care what you give John Pinch. Give him a stick bow, give him a compound bow, or give him a Tika off the shelf. He's still going to kill it.
Oh, I totally agree with that bow reference. And you got to take in microclimates. And I say this all the time. It would be easier for me to kill a big bull elk in unit 4, 5, and 6, 7 in Idaho than it is with a long-range rifle, just because of the terrain.
100%. And some of that crap that you guys hunt up there in northern Idaho, you could have the biggest, baddest rifle in the world. It ain't going to do you a bit of good. It's not going to do anything for you.
Yeah, and then you take the guys, like, I do go to southern Idaho because you see more animals. But just because I see an animal at 800, 900, 1200 yards doesn't mean it's going to be done. There's all kinds of variables that fall into there. Namely 100%. Fog, wind, the animal moves. I can't get a steady enough position, and that's going back to when you need to know when not to shoot. And I think Bob and you guys in Extreme Outer Limit, you guys portray that in your in your show better than any other long-range show, and that's why Tanya and I enjoy that show.
100%. We just had a perfect example of this on this hunt. We almost killed a bull that we were going to come in on, and Bob, it was going to be about a 750-yard shot. I'll give a little plug to OnX Maps right here. That new feature where you can do the line distance to where I'm going to shoot from and where that animal is, and I can get a kind of a relative prediction as far as what that shot would be. We found out the shot was going to be right around 800 yards, which in great conditions, that's an all-day thing for Bob Beck. I mean, it's not even a second thought. But we had sustained 20 to 30 mile-an-hour winds that day, and before we even went down there, Bob said, today is not the day for that shot. There's just no way we could do it. We're not going to be able to get him killed right there effectively.
Yeah, and I think that message needs to get out more. You got a guy like Bob Beck who he can shoot long range. I mean, a normal nice day, 15, 2,000 yards is not a really hard shot for Bob Beck.
Yep.
And he didn't shoot at a live animal at 800 yards. I hope that is portrayed in your guys' show.
For sure. I mean, he comes out just to give him a little plug. He comes to our advanced shooting schools and he shoots the whole course standing up with all the students. So all the students are laying prone all day long and they're shooting the targets and doing this. And Bob takes one shot standing and hits all the targets during the course. I mean, it just shows what he's capable of. And that shows he knows his limits though. Exactly. And he knows that's beyond the outer limits of what he's capable of doing effectively and ethically. And he passes on that shot. And I do think that has to be shown to everybody. There's so many people out there that put this Frankenstein rifle together with this action and this barrel and this, and they get a scope and they think they're ready to go. Because, you know, I ran it through a chronograph and it said 3,200 feet a second. So I'm going to get a turret cut for 3,200 feet a second and I'm ready to rock, you know. That is dangerous shit right there. Like, that is super dangerous.
Yeah, I tested out the Husqvarna this year for really the first time. And after shooting their system, which I guess in a perfect situation it works, but I automatically emailed them and got two MOA turrets sent to me because there was some big varying differences, and they have some formula where you can use that 1,500 yards above the elevation that ballistic turret's for, or 1,500 yards below.
Yeah, and that's where you got to be.
At all.
Yeah, and we know that it all boils, you know, when they're asking you for temperature and elevation, it's all boiling down to barometric pressure, right? That's what they're going to be cutting on that turret the entire time. I have this conversation with people very often, and they're always asking that. And some people are, I mean, you have to rip a yardage turret out of their hands because they think that MOA or mil radians is this just giant concept that they can't conceive. And I'm like, hey, trust me, there's retarded privates all over the military that figure this out. So you can definitely do that.
There's retarded officers that figure it out.
Yeah, you can figure this out. No problem. I promise you. And once you show them that system and how effective it can be hunting doll sheep in the Northwest Territories down to mule deer in Sonora, they go, okay, this makes sense. And this is the best system for hunting without a doubt. That's the way I need to do it.
It's far simpler to learn MOA or mils off the get-go than go into that ballistic turret bullshit if you're truly
totally
shoot long range.
And if a guy is really – and if I'm being completely transparent, a yardage turret is going to get most guys to 600 yards all day long pretty damn effectively. And if a guy is just fighting me tooth and nail on wanting a yardage turret, we can do that, but I just tell them, okay, but we're putting MOA on the turret as well, because when this fails you, I want to have a backup plan. And it's not if it fails you, it's when it fails you.
Nice. Well, I think we hit that enough. I wanted to get into, I've never really heard you talk about, how did your wife get into hunting? Had she hunted her whole life, or did she get into it late, or how'd that
Yeah, my wife, when I met her, you know, she's born and raised in this small town in Eastern Oregon here. So she had hunted and she killed some deer but not nearly to the level that I kind of indoctrinated her. And she says the story better than I, so we'll have to get her on here sometime. But she said, you know, I quickly figured out with this guy, if I wanted to hang out with him or see him, I needed to start hunting. And so she started hunting, and it was really great for a few years. She was muzzleloader hunting for cow elk late season. So we'd get like this extra elk at the end of the year, and she killed half a dozen of those. And then she all of a sudden was like, well, I want to kill a bull. And then she wants to start bow hunting. And it was, so it's been awesome to see her progress and like take the same progressions that any hunter would, male or female. And I got to watch her kill her first bull with a bow last year. And there were screams and there were tears and it was like the coolest thing. I've never got to experience my own kids killing an animal, but I imagine it'd be pretty similar. Watching her shoot a bull with a bow was the most amazing thing I've got to have. And she just threw her bow. I mean, it was amazing.
I love the story. I don't remember which podcast you're on. Have you guys, when she drew that sheep tag, borrowing the rifle.
Oh, yeah.
Having to stay in your car. That's all about. Those are the things you'll never, ever forget that people don't understand about hunting.
Yeah. I mean, she's got that girl's killed 193-inch bighorn sheep. I'll probably never get to say that. But we did that. That is freaking I was 20 years old. She was 19, you know. And we quickly – I learned that if she's able to deal with that, I mean, that girl could probably deal with anything. And it made her tough right off the bat. And I tell you, she's 36 weeks pregnant right now, and it's absolutely killing her that she hasn't really been able to hunt much this year herself. She absolutely loves it. So next year, I think she's going to get a couple rifle tags and we're going to get after it. But she really, truly enjoys it. She grits down and does it. And she's tougher than a lot of guys that I hunt with. So I love it.
I say that about Tanya. Tanya's tougher than a lot of the guys I've hunted with.
Yeah. The cool thing is I can tell she has a genuine passion for it. It's not just because I do it. She actually really enjoys it, going out and doing it. And because she chooses to do it more, you know, it's like, well, I want to kill an elk with a bow. And I'm like, well, Shelby, you'd be way more likely to kill an elk with your muzzleloader or with, you know, a rifle or this or that. No, I want to do it with a bow. That's just what I want to do. And she goes out and gets it done. That's just, it's pretty fun.
Well, that's awesome, Cal. Seems like you got the right formula going on over there in Oregon.
Yeah, I'm pretty lucky. Pretty lucky. Not really smart, but pretty lucky.
Speaking of that, how did your podcast with Schneider go?
Aaron, if you're listening to this, you text me and said we'd podcast in 30 minutes, and that was 36 hours ago. So still waiting.
Oh, that is awesome. Well, Cal, how can people find you and how can they find your outfitting business?
Sure. Yeah, we're on Facebook and Instagram, Sheep Mountain Outfitters. My name on Instagram is Cal_Halliday, my last name. All A's, like Holiday, but all A's.
Yeah, and I confuse that sometimes for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. And other than that, I'm pretty easy to find. I get a lot of messages from guys all the time, and I try and get back to everybody. I'm not the best at it, but I usually will. Even if it's weeks later, I'll sit down and knock them out.
That's awesome. I appreciate you sitting down. We'll have to get Shelby on here to hear the real truth.
You better. You better get her on here. No, I mean, she's the real star of this show, without a doubt.
Oh, dude.
We'll get Bob. Really, I finally got Bob on the podcast gig, so we'll get him on here, and if we can tie him down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, now don't forget, the Stream Outer Limits started the podcast, so if you listen to this, check it out, because I think it'll be very entertaining.
Yeah, Bob and Kelly McMillan have kind of done a joint venture. We're going to do a podcast together on everything from PRS, shooting sports, to long-range hunting. A lot of hunting-specific things. I'll be on there quite a bit. It should be a good gig. There's nobody really besides Avery Adventures that talks about long-range shooting or hunting on a podcast. So I think it's good to get the good information from the industry leaders out there.
Oh, I agree 100%. I think there's so many – it's not really voodoo per se, but there's so many wrong ways to do it, and I think those come out more than the right ways to do it.
There's a ton of misconception out there, and I get to see it with our shooting school students all the time. I know we've talked about them a lot, but they'll show up there with apprehensions, or a lot of them think it's unethical right when they start. They actually just want to see for themselves what they can be capable of doing, and they walk away with a completely different perspective.
Yeah, and I know we're trying to wrap this up, but on the bow hunting side, I've killed a bull with my bow at 5 feet. I killed a bull a few years ago at 1583. I was just wrapped up. I was just amped up for both as I, either one, didn't matter. I was amped for both.
It is hunting, and it's just different. It's totally different. I still bow hunt, and I still rifle hunt. I love them both. Totally separate. Bob even told me that next year he's picking a bow up, and he's doing a bow hunt. So, I mean, a hunter's a hunter. An elk's an elk. It always will be.
I agree.
And an experience is an experience. I mean, they're going to be awesome no matter what they are. Just they're going to be different.
And who's to tell you, Tanya, what your experience can be or shouldn't be, right?
They do it very well.
Tell mom, right? Well, good. Right. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being on.
Thanks, Cal.